Hello and welcome to the Annals of Internal Medicine podcast. It's April 21st, 2026, and I'm Dr. Christine Lane, Annals Editor-in-Chief, with a quick overview of what's new on annals.org. Let's not waste any time and get right to the new articles. The appropriate duration of antibiotics to treat community-acquired pneumonia seems to be a topic of endless debate. The first article I'll highlight helps to inform that debate. It is a multi-center target trial emulation that suggests that for patients who are hospitalized, do not require ICU care, and are stable by day 3, health outcomes were similar whether they received a 3 to 4 day course of antibiotics or a course lasting 5 days or more. Researchers from the University of Texas Southwestern, University of Michigan, and University of Utah sought to evaluate whether short antibiotic courses are safe for adults hospitalized with community-acquired pneumonia who show early clinical stability. Researchers analyzed data from patients across 67 Michigan hospitals between 2017 and 2024 to compare outcomes for patients who received 3 or 4 days of antibiotics with those treated for 5 days or longer. Among the 10% of patients who met the strict criteria for short course therapy, the researchers found no clinically meaningful differences in mortality, readmissions, urgent care visits, or C. diff infections. In an accompanying editorial, Drs. Josh Matley and Atish Chowdhury write, quote, "Unrelated to the comparison of the evaluated treatment approaches, the median duration of antibiotics for all patients eligible for a short course of treatment in the current study was 7 days. This is striking given the national guidelines since at least 2007 began recommending a 5 day course of antibiotics for most patients with community-acquired pneumonia who are responding to treatment." So even if the current study did not conclusively demonstrate that less than 5 days of treatment is equivalent to 5 days or more, there is no justification for the ongoing use of even longer durations of antibiotic treatment for most adults with uncomplicated community-acquired pneumonia, end quote. Next is a new Beyond the Guidelines feature in which a primary care physician and a neurologist discuss the management of young women with frequent migraine headaches. Their discussion is framed within the context of the 2025 International Headache Society and American College of Physicians guidelines for migraine pharmacotherapy, which differ in their recommendations for first-line and escalation therapies. Go to annals.org to view a video of the full Grand Rounds program, read the accompanying article, and earn CME and MOC credits if you do. While the discussants disagree about the role of costly new agents, they agree that migraine management should be individualized and informed by headache frequency, functional impairment, comorbidities, reproductive goals, and patient preference. Hypoglossal nerve stimulation is an FDA-approved alternative therapy for obstructive sleep apnea in patients who cannot tolerate nasal positive airway pressure. Proximal hypoglossal nerve stimulation has emerged as a possible treatment option for sleep apnea that offers more stimulation of the tongue and airway muscles and easier implementation. A newly published trial randomized 104 adults aged 22 and older with moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea at 23 U.S. health centers to receive proximal hypoglossal nerve stimulation therapy immediately, the treatment group, or at month 7, the control group. Primary endpoint was apnea hypopnea index below 20 events per hour at month 7, and other outcomes measured included oxygen desaturation index, patient-reported outcomes, and safety. After 7 months, 58.2% of patients in the treatment group achieved the primary endpoint, and patients reported feeling less sleepy during the day. In contrast, clinically meaningful improvements were not observed in the control group through month 7. Continued improvements were seen in the treatment group following a 6-month open-label extension of the trial. No serious complications related to the procedure were reported, suggesting proximal hypoglossal nerve stimulation may be a reasonable option for patients who cannot tolerate traditional sleep apnea treatments, though longer and larger studies are still needed. Next is a report of a sequential multiple-assignment randomized trial that found that people with chronic low back pain experienced slight improvement in daily function when starting treatment with physical therapy compared to starting treatment with cognitive behavioral therapy. After 10 weeks, participants who started with physical therapy showed a small improvement in function, though pain levels were similar between groups. After 1 year, however, no meaningful differences were seen among second stage treatments. The findings suggest physical therapy may be a reasonable first option for chronic low back pain, but switching or adding other therapies later may not change long-term outcomes. Migraine affects roughly 15% of Americans and is the second leading cause of disability among all adults and the leading cause among females aged 15 to 59. Despite its prevalence and impact, it is often underdiagnosed and undertreated. As part of an initiative to recommend core performance measures for internal medicine physicians, the American College of Physicians Performance Measurement Committee searched for existing U.S. performance measures related to migraine headache and identified just one. Applying ACP's measure review criteria, ACP found the measure lacks appropriate testing and key exclusions, relies on outdated guidance, and addresses a minimal performance gap. Further, ACP concluded the measure adds unnecessary reporting burden for individual physicians. For these reasons, ACP does not recommend adopting a core performance measure for migraine at this time. The 340B drug pricing program is part of a federal agreement that gives select healthcare entities that serve low-income and uninsured patients the opportunity to purchase heavily discounted drugs. The program exists to maximize federal resources while expanding treatment options for underserved populations, but shortcomings in its design, complexity, implementation, and oversight have created inadvertent incentives for some healthcare organizations to undertake profit-seeking behaviors. In a new American College of Physicians policy paper, ACP urges policy changes to protect the program and ensure it meets the intended mission of helping medically indigent populations. Next are two ideas and opinions commentaries. One discusses reframing social drivers of health in efforts to improve healthcare quality and safety. The second commentary proposes automatic tenure clock extensions as safeguards for researchers who have been defunded. The last three articles I'll highlight were featured in a plenary session at IM 2026, the annual meeting of the American College of Physicians. The first detailed ACP's new mammography screening guidance statement. The ACP recommends that women at average risk between the ages of 50 and 74 should undergo biennial mammography screening for breast cancer. Women between the ages of 40 and 49 should discuss with their doctor their risk for breast cancer and the benefits and harms of screening, such as false positive results, psychological distress, overdiagnosis, overtreatment, additional testing, and radiation exposure, before making a shared decision about screening. The second article discussed findings of a study comparing the quality of clinical notes generated by ambient AI scribe tools or those written by human clinicians. The researchers compared recordings of 5 standardized primary care visits and asked 11 AI scribe tools and 18 human clinicians to generate clinical notes from them. In every case and by every measure, human notes scored better than AI notes for accuracy, thoroughness, usefulness, organization, and comprehensiveness. While AI scribe tools may reduce administrative burden, the authors suggest that they should be regarded as a tool for generating draft documentation that requires careful review and editing. The authors warn that AI is currently no substitute for clinician-authored notes. The third article is a systematic review that evaluated 36 randomized controlled trials reporting on body composition outcomes among adults with overweight or obesity taking liraglutide, semaglutide, tirzepatide, or dulaglutide compared with non-pharmacological interventions or placebo. They found that while the medications reduced total weight, body fat, and visceral fat, the proportion of weight lost from muscle-related tissue was concerning. The authors note that half of the placebo lifestyle interventions examined in included studies also exceeded pre-specified benchmarks for muscle-related loss, despite these interventions often leading to more modest weight loss. The researchers stress the need for clinicians to proactively counsel patients around muscle-related losses associated with weight reduction and muscle-preserving strategies to incorporate alongside pharmacotherapy. That brings us to the end of this podcast. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll go to annals.org to take a closer look at some of the new material I've mentioned. Thanks to Beth Jenkinson, Andrew Langman, and Bernie Turner for their technical support.